So last time, let me start with a recap from the first lecture. So the main points was that gravity was a manifestation of space-time curvature. In particular, the two slogans that you might keep in mind is that space-time sort of tells matter how to move. And the simplest example of that comes from the geodesic equation when the matter happens to be a test particle that doesn't have any internal degrees of freedom or any other forces acting on it. The trajectory, which we can describe in some coordinates, which are up to us to pick. There's a curve parameterized by some affine parameter, and that curve is given by the geodesic equation, x double dot mu plus gamma mu alpha beta x dot mu, alpha x dot beta is zero. So that's one part. Another part is that matter, in turn, tells space-time how to curve. And this is encapsulated by the Einstein's equation. Let me just abbreviate it to EEQ, which is the Ricci tensor minus half of the Ricci scalar times the metric. In principle, you can put in a cosmological constant term, cosmological constant lambda, and this is all given by a stress tensor, d mu nu, that describes the matter distribution in the universe. And I guess you heard a little bit more explicitly what these stress tensors are like. Different forms of matter would have different stress tensors. And you have to solve sort of for the curvature and the matter distribution self-consistently. Okay, so this gives a complicated set of PDEs, coupled nonlinear second order PDEs. And so this is not, in general, it's very hard to solve. And in fact, there's sort of three types of things people recourse to. So either you can have a large enough amount of symmetry in your physical situation that you're trying to describe, such that you can, you know, write a simple ansatz for the metric, and the set of Einstein's equations simplify sufficiently for you to solve it analytically. And there are many solutions like that, and we'll see today two specific ones, the simplest black hole in four dimensions and Di-de-Sitter spacetime. When you know, your symmetry becomes, well, your situation you're trying to describe is less and less symmetric. It's more and more difficult set of equations to solve, and at some point is just too hard to solve. And so then one thing that you can do is sort of try to find solutions which are sufficiently nearby to solutions you already know that you can do perturbative techniques. And
to achieve black holes and ABS solutions, you assume some symmetry and
you do. Yeah.
So these
guys will be very symmetric. In fact, this is maximally symmetric, and this is has large number of symmetries. This is static and spherically symmetric. So we'll see in a moment how to do that. But let me just say if that fails. Okay, so this is not, so most of the content of standard GR courses is at the level of having enough symmetries. If that fails, so either you can use these perturbative techniques and solve, look at solutions which are nearby to something you already know, then you could use linearized Einstein's equations, which are much simpler, and then you can, you know, expand around such a solution, or maybe you know a solution somewhere, you know a solution somewhere else, and the regimes of validity, you know, match, so you can use what's called matched asymptotic expansion and things like that. There's various types of perturbative techniques. Or you can go all the way to full generality and try to use numerics. But if you just put this system on the computer, so if you solve for, so this is solved for sort of all the components g mu nu of the space-time coordinates and self-consistently for the stress tensor, even if this is zero, this was a complicated system. But if you put arbitrary functions for the metric, so for example, you have, you know, g 0, 0 of x 0, x 1, and so forth, g 0, 1 of these coordinates, and so forth. Okay, even just putting that on a computer and trying to figure out the form of the equations is already very hard, much less solving it. So numerically, you still typically recourse to situations which have some symmetry. But you can solve lots of interesting things, and in fact, late, you know, in the last year, with the excitement with detecting, you know, gravitational waves a few months ago, there has been lots of, excitement about solving situations that are relevant for astrophysical, what's happening out there in the universe, you know, black holes orbiting and merging and, you know, things of that sort. So that type of thing you can evolve now, and it has been a big progress in the last few years on the numerical relativity front. Okay, but I'm not going to say anything more about that. Just as a recap of what we did, the other main point of last time is that the sort of local structure of space-time was sort of Lorentzian, so it had a light cone at every point. So this is a Lorentzian spacetime, and so every point in a, say, P in a manifold, the metric had a light cone which had a well-defined sort of future. I guess this is getting too small, but the past of that point, and sort of the so the directions along this light cone are so-called non-separated or light-like separated, and in the space-like separated regions, you can't signal to from this point. So this would be sort of no signal can propagate from this point P if you're out here in this region. Okay, and this. So specification of a light cone at every point in the geometry then gives us what we call the causal structure, which characterizes which set of points in the space-time can communicate with which other set of points in the space-time. And this causal structure can be quite non-trivial. So in flat space-time, you basically, the structure is like this globally. You can communicate to points which are just, you know, more separated in time than in space. But we'll see with the first example with black holes that there are some points from which, you know, no matter how long you wait in time, you still can't get arbitrarily sort of communicate arbitrarily far out in space and so forth. There are much more extreme examples of non-trivial causal structure in other solutions. In fact, in principle, you can certainly write down metrics that have, closed time-like curves, time machines, and whatnot. But the black holes that I'll talk about are reasonably tame. They just have regions of space-time from which no signal can ever get out. Far away to infinity. Okay, so that's the first part that I'll. So before I go there, are there any questions from the first lecture? Yeah.
So there's one question on the equation. You put always explicitly this g mu. Why is are you keeping that unit and not any other unit?
Oh, right. Actually, I don't really know. So this is, I mean, really, one can set. I should be setting this to one because I have been setting speed of light to one, and indeed, it's sort of mysterious why I'm keeping it. So you can, it's, yeah. So here, speed of light didn't appear explicitly, and in the metric that I go down for flat space, there should have been a speed of light multiplying the t, the time, and I have set that to one implicitly, but you know, you can certainly, and people do set the Newton's constant to one as well. So this was just a redundancy, if you will. Yeah. So the answer is just sloppiness. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so I think I will go to the black hole a bit. Okay, and I'll talk about the Schwarzschild. The so-called Schwarzschild solution. Okay, which is a static, spherically symmetric solution to vacuum. By vacuum, I mean T mu nu being zero. And zero cosmological constant situation, Einstein's equations. Okay, so you have no matter, you have no cosmological constant. And this describes if the space-time is vacuum, you know, everywhere, it describes a static black hole, a spherical black hole. And you can have, say, a star inside which the stress tensor is non-zero, but outside which, okay, if you ignore the radiation of the star, it's approximately vacuum. Okay, so outside, wherever in the space-time there is vacuum, you can still have this solution. So it also describes a space-time around or outside as, you know, static spherically symmetric object. So let me just call it a star. And so it's relevant, the solution approximately describes the curvature of space-time around the Earth or, you know, around the sun and so forth. So so maybe I should sort of say the overall picture of GR as opposed to Newtonian gravity in a situation, for example, like this. Let's take Earth orbiting the sun. Okay, in Newtonian description, we would have said that the Earth accelerates on a circular trajectory around the sun because it's acted on by a force due to, that's just a gravitational force due to the sun's mass. In Einstein's theory of gravity, we say the Earth follows a geodesic, it does not accelerate, but it follows a geodesic in a curved space-time, which is given, which is curved by the sun's presence, by the sun's mass. Okay, so the solution, this curved space-time solution that we're just about to find, is precisely the thing that, you know, tells us why Earth orbits the sun.
So is just flat Minkowski spacetime just a special case of this?
No, so flat Minkowski spacetime is flat, and this is going to be distinct from that. This is going to be curved.
Okay. So then why did we say that this describes like spacetime far away from a... Oh, be good.
Well, far away is going to be what's called asymptotically flat.
Right.
But near here,
okay.
I mean, the Earth doesn't run off...
Okay, so you don't mean asymptotically far away, just somewhat far away.
Well, you know, Earth orbits the sun, so it's near enough. Okay.
I got it.
Okay, so what does one do? Well, of course, one doesn't write a generic ansatz for the metric. Here we don't have to worry about the strength sensor, but even the metric, one doesn't write this generic ansatz. One uses the symmetries to simplify the ansatz. And so since it's static, so choice of coordinates, let me say choose coordinates based on symmetries. So we have the staticity, the static, the fact that the spacetime we want is static. So we'll choose T such that all the G mu nu's are independent of this coordinate. We'll call it time. Moreover, if it's static as opposed to stationary, it means that it's also time reversal symmetric. If you flip the direction of time, it still looks the same. And so all the off-diagonal components which have some component and a T are zero. Okay, so it's going to be sort of at least block diagonal like this. Since it's spherically symmetric, you can choose coordinates, let's call them traditionally theta and phi, such that the only dependence on these coordinates is in the usual spherical, two sphere like metric with some. I'll say only dependence on theta and phi comes through the sort of two-sphere metric. So let me introduce a notation d omega squared to denote a unit two-sphere metric that we found or wrote last time. So there will be some dependence on theta, but it will only appear this way. And we can set the radial coordinate to measure the size of these spheres. So we'll say that the area of a given two-sphere at a given radius. Okay, so the picture here is you have a space-time which is very symmetric, which is sort of foliated by these two spheres like that. This radial coordinate will give us an area of 4 pi r squared. Okay, so r itself, although it's called radial coordinate, it does not measure a proper distance from an origin to a given two-sphere. In fact, there might not even be an origin in the space-time, as is the case in our Schwarzschild solution. But it's going to correspond to something that measures the proper area of this given surface. Okay, so putting this together, we'll have a metric ansatz that's the most general sort of describes arbitrary static spherically symmetric solution. So I'll write it as some function of this radial coordinate r dt squared, okay, that will be the only dependence of this t, plus some other a priori arbitrary function of time dr squared, and then the sphere which will be simply multiplied by r squared, I'll just write d omega squared, okay, let's substitute in this for the d omega squared. Okay, so that's our ansatz. So now this you can take and basically by hand evaluate what is the left-hand side of the Einstein's equation in terms of these two functions of one variable. Okay, so now our set of a priori 10 nonlinear coupled PDEs has simplified for four variables, has simplified to just, in fact, three ordinary second-order differential equations, still coupled, for two functions of a single variable r. Okay, so I won't write them down, but they're easy enough. They're just one line long equations, these guys, as opposed to pages and pages if you did the generic thing. But the solution, so I haven't even given this for the homework, but it can be done for homework, and you know, if you're curious, I encourage you to actually compute this and solve it. The solution is that f of r is 1 over h of r, and it's 1 plus some constant over r. Let's already put in the conventions, well, make that constant physical. Okay, so m, so really this should be g newton over c squared to really reinstate the units, but I'll set this to 1, where m is, let me put this up here, the m corresponds to the mass of this object, of the black hole. Yeah, I haven't yet explained why I'm calling this a black hole, but let me just take that as the name of this object we have found the metric for. Okay, so it's a one-parameter family of solutions. Okay, so which solves the vacuum Einstein's equations, is static and spherically symmetric. And now, for the first part of the lecture, I'll sort of talk about the geometry, the physics of this. Okay, so when we set this parameter to 0, oh, by the way, I should say, why am I calling this the mass? So now if you go far away, GR looks like Newtonian gravity, and you can figure out, you know, orbits in this geometry and identify it with orbits in Newtonian gravity, and that's what allows us to identify this as the mass. Okay, so when the mass is 0, there is nothing curving the space-time. The space-time is just the standard, well, let me write the full metric here again. Dt squared plus dr squared over 1 minus over r plus r squared, writing the two sphere out explicitly. Okay, I have this. So when mass is 0, these two terms disappear, and I just have the flat space-time and spherical coordinates. Okay, so this gives it precisely the Minkowski, reduces to the Minkowski space-time, which is by the flat space-time. There was a question?
Yes. Yeah. So you said that you were defining the R such that the area element was...
the areas of the two spheres, the proper areas.
The proper distance from the origin is not the one...
It's not R. The proper distance is not R. In fact, you can find the proper distance, say you have a space-like curve that's only going radially, doesn't go in the angles and doesn't move in time. The proper distance is just the integral of square root of h of r dr. Okay, and you can see that for this guy, this is not...
Another question. So in Newtonian gravity, we expect that the anti-gravity is this proper distance.
In Newtonian gravity, we don't have the space-time being curved. So
right.
This proper distance in the, well, what we would have called.
And you say that in the large R limit, you recover Minkowski.
That's right, because this is just dr squared.
So the R's coincide in large.
That's right. So you can, again, you can just read it off the metric. For my space-like curve that I mentioned a moment ago, this is zero, and this is just 1, so you integrate dr to find the proper distance, which is just r, which gets linearly with r. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. So, yeah, so good. So let's talk about the physical case. M is big. The interesting case, m is greater than 0. Okay, so as this was just noticed, as r goes to infinity, the metric again goes to the Minkowski metric. So in spherical coordinates. So Schwarzschild solution is asymptotically flat. Which means that the boundary of the space-time, which is at infinite r, has a specific structure. Now there are two interesting, as you go in from large R. So the picture, the cartoon you can have in mind for this is, if you had just flat space, then there would be a relation between from any point that you can think of as an origin. If you take a sphere around it, there would be a simple relation between, say, the perimeter around a circle and or area of a sphere and a distance from the origin. Here, this is going to get deformed as R gets closer to 2m, and this factor starts playing a role. And in fact, what's going to happen is that you'll get a sort of a gravitational potential well, and in this sort of two-dimensional cartoon, the space-time will start curving. And if you have a star or something that caps off the validity of this vacuum solution at some point, let's say that R is still much bigger than m, then you'll have some metric of a star inside, and it will be just a little dimple in the space-time. But what we'll see with this solution that actually is valid, you know, everywhere, we'll see that the sort of spatial geometry at some constant time will, in fact, do something really weird. It will come in up to R equal to 2m, but then for this constant time, well, there will, we see something fishy is happening with the coordinates there. But in fact, this will go down and open up in another asymptotic region like this. Okay, so that's what we'll find in a moment. Okay, but for now, let's just stare at the line element a little bit. So as R goes to M, you see that, well, first of all, GTT is zero and GRR is infinite, which looks bad. But in fact, this is just a coordinate singularity. And we'll see in a moment that we can get rid of it by a suitable change of coordinates. So remove via change of coordinates. Okay. If you have something that looks badly singular, you don't know a priori whether it can be removed. It could look singular just because I have introduced some singular coordinate transformation of something very innocuous. I can do this in flat space time too. But sometimes you can't remove it. And one indicator when you cannot remove it is when the curvature itself diverges. Okay, and well, curvature as some coordinate independent object, so it's best to take the scalar quantities constructed from a curvature. So this will be the case for R being zero. There, I mean, it doesn't look much worse. GRR in this case would be zero and GTT would be infinite. Okay, you might say, okay, well, why is it any worse? And here it actually turns out to be a curvature singularity. The metric is certainly not invertible at that point. And one way, again, that you can detect it is if you look at the, so it's a vacuum solution. So the Ricci scalar is, of course, zero. The Ricci tensor is zero, but the Riemann tensor is non-zero. But to get a scalar quantity that we can, we don't have to worry about, again, coordinate singularities for, we can just take all the indices and contract them in some way. And this is one nice way to do it. This is something that people call Kretschmann scalar. And if you evaluate this quantity everywhere, anywhere in the space-time, you get something like 48m squared over r to the sixth. And of course, that goes to infinity as r goes to zero. And so this invariant made out of a curvature blows up, which tells you that the space-time is really getting infinitely curved at what you would have thought of as the origin. So that is a curvature singularity. And in fact, r equal to zero is not part of your space-time. So here we have no origin at r equal to 0. OK, so that's sort of a structure that you can sort of find with a little bit of calculation once you find the Riemann. Yeah?
What is exactly the meaning of this Ricci Riemannian tensor?
It tells you, so the full for indexing tells you, roughly speaking, if you have a, well, there are various ways you can think about it. One way is to think about it is to say if you have in your Kerr spacetime, if you have two geodesics which are initially parallel, and you look at how they sort of accelerate, how the distance between them changes as you go along them, they're going to, the variation in that, the acceleration, is given precisely by the Riemann tensor. So there's sort of two of these indices get mocked up by sort of which, by how, what is happening to, you know, the deviation and tour. The other way of thinking about it is this parallel transporting a vector along some closed loop, and again figuring out how that changes as you take the, you know, limit of the loop shrinking to zero. So locally, you can always expand around any point in space-time that to sort of first order it looks flat, but to second order you pick up exactly this. The deviation from flat space-time is exactly given by this curvature.
So again, all this information is not encoded already in G?
It is encoded in G. You can find the Riemann tensor directly by a formula from G itself. Except that the curvature, well, G is subject to, okay, so let me go there after the talk, because this will give me too much of a detour for what I want to say. But yeah, you can calculate the Riemann tensor from G, and so all the information is in G, but the curvature is, you can think of it much more physically than the talk. Okay, yeah.
I just want to understand how much I should be able to read off from the picture that you drew on the right, and whether it's just a caricature or whether you can say embed a two-dimensional space in a three-dimensional Euclidean space as long as the cosmological constant is zero.
No, you cannot do that in general. But in fact, for the embedding diagram of Schwarzschild at what I have done at constant time, that you can. So I can show you again after the class, I can show you exactly what would be the actual plot, you know, of this thing if I were to actually plot it. So basically this is supposed to be a proper distance from some radial coordinate that's sort of isometric like this. And this is supposed to be the perimeter. And I'm ignoring the, of course, the other two sphere.
R equals 0 is the
sort of
this double panel.
Well, so R equal to 0 you don't get to till you take care of this coordinate singularity. So let's wait a bit and we'll get there. We'll get at least partially there. Okay. Other questions for what I have said so far? Okay. Okay, so let's, before I leave this list, the M less than zero is sort of unphysical. It has a very different structure because, of course, you don't have the metric GTT and GTT is now everywhere negative, and GRR is everywhere positive. But you still have this. You still have this curvature singularity. The singularity has a different structure. It will turn out that for positive M, the singularity is space-like, and here it would be time-like, but it's not cloaked by anything. So it will turn out that this is a horizon that cloaks the singularity. That won't be the case here because we have no horizon, and in fact, it's what people call a naked singularity. And there's a conjecture that you can sort of create this in nature from regular initial conditions, and typically you know, apart from a mathematical curiosity, we won't, you know, we won't consider this henceforth. This was just for completeness. It is a solution because we had a full one-parameter family of solutions, but it's not physical. Okay, so let's focus on this positive M case. That's the interesting one, and talk about the geometry a bit more. And one nice way of sort of understanding what the geometry is doing without having to worry about, you know, coordinate artifacts is to look at geodesics. Okay, so we'll look at geodesics in Schwarzschild. And I have left you one of the problem sets to for you to sort of derive what these things actually look like. So let me just sort of give you the upshot. Well, basically, the simplification here is again to use the symmetries of the spacetime to get sort of the constants of motion along any given geodesic. So if you use the time translation symmetry of the metric, there you can see that, you know, if you move in t, nothing, if you shift t, nothing happens. So that gives us a conserved quantity, a constant of motion, which I'll call the energy of the geodesic, which is given by plus 1 minus 2m over r times t dot. T dot is just dt d lambda for a given geodesic with characterized by, you know, t of lambda, r of lambda, eta of lambda, phi of lambda. There's another explicit constant of motion given by the orbital, the rotational invariance in phi, which I call the angular momentum. That's given by r squared sine squared theta phi dot. Okay, so this was energy. This was angular momentum for the geodesic per sort of unit mass. Okay, nobody really bothers saying that. And there's, in fact, the full spherical symmetry where the other rotational invariance is not manifest in the way that I'm writing the metric, still gives you a simplification because I can sort of, without loss of generality, if I'm talking about single geodesic, I can say that geodesic happens to be in an equatorial plane. And you can check from the full, you know, geodesic equations that I can set then the theta to be in the equatorial plane, meaning pi over 2. And the geodesic equations are not going to let me deviate from that. Basically, anytime you have a flip symmetry and you're at the symmetric point, you know, the geodesic can't break that symmetry. So you can set theta being pi over 2, so this will just be 1. And you can forget about, you know, figuring out what happens to theta. It's just saying pi over 2. Yeah.
So what does this expression mean? Like, I mean, dt give you e equals
this. This means that because there's a invariance, so in general, if you have, you know, if g mu nu itself does not depend on some, let's say, x rho, then it turns out that x dot rho, which you can think of as g mu rho, x dot mu summed over mu, this quantity is constant of motion. In fact, that's a much more general statement, but you know, for the application, practical application, this is what you need to know. So here I'm saying the line element up there is independent of t. None of the g mu nu's depend on t, which means that this quantity, which is just that evaluated, is independent of lambda. So each of these, so r is a function of lambda, t is a function of lambda. So each of them depend on lambda as you go along a geodesic. But this combination of this function of lambda times this function of lambda actually happens to be independent of lambda. That's what I mean by constant of motion, and the way you calculate it is that. Okay, so we have two constants of motion. In fact, there's a third one, which is because we have found a finely parameterized geodesic, the norm of the tension vector along the geodesic is also conserved. And so norm of tangent vector, let's call this kappa. Unfortunately, this afternoon you'll see another meaning of kappa, so this is, be careful about the notation. This is just what I'll define to be, let's say, p mu, where this is the tangent to a geodesic. This happens to be either plus one for space-like geodesics, zero for null geodesics, or minus one for time-like geodesics. Okay, because it's just these constants, it's independent of lambda. Okay, so you have some geodesic, you have a tangent vector p mu, you have its norm. Here the p mu will be pointing some other way, but the norm, okay, in space, that would be like the length of this, is staying constant. And in fact, we have normalized it to be plus one. Similarly, if it's time-like, it would be minus one. Okay, so now we can use this, write this out explicitly in terms of these guys in the line element. So this is the dot product here is minus 1 minus 2m over r t dot squared plus r dot squared over 1 minus 2m over r plus r squared. In principle, there would have been a theta dot squared, but that's set to 0. Plus sine squared theta, which is set to 1 because theta was pi half, phi dot squared. But now we don't have to. So this is a simplification of, instead of having a second order differential equation for the geodesic equations, we have just now a set of first order ones. We have this for t, this for phi. And this, in fact, we can plug these back in here to get an equation just for r. Okay, so this gives us an effective sort of 1D problem or motion in effective potential. And we can, in fact, think of this. So we have replaced this guy by E squared over this quantity squared and so forth, and this guy by L squared over R squared squared. Okay. Like that. So we can write this as R dot, or 1/2 R dot squared plus some effective potential of R is zero, where you can think of this as the kinetic energy and potential energy and total energy of some particle in some effective potential. So once you write the effective potential, it gives you a lot of intuition. It's really like having a, you know, little marble rolling on a hill whose shape is given by this function of R. Okay, and you can already figure out what's happening to that. Yeah.
It's sort of well known, but would you explain how you, is it an axiom that mass moves along geodesics, or can you sort of derive it from?
Well, test mass moves along geodesics when it's not acted on by any force, and it's almost basically by definition, geodesic is a curve with no acceleration. Okay, so you can recourse back, I mean, to motivate it, you can recourse back to, Newton's second law, right? There is no force acting on the particle, it doesn't accelerate, it follows what would be the straightest possible curved, trajectory, but now in the curved space-time, which is that straightest possible path is a geodesic.
But okay, you have to impose it. I mean, you don't really derive it somehow. It's not coming out of the equation?
I don't derive it. Well, yeah, I mean, the geodesic equation itself would come out of Einstein's equation if you put a stress tensor corresponding to a point particle. Mm.
But the fact that this particle moves along the geodesic is somehow a law. Well, yeah, okay. I guess at this level, instead of, you can call it a law. I think it's a, yeah. I mean, it feels like a self-evident thing, and it's also derivable from the Einstein's equation, but I guess, yeah, okay, let's leave it at the level of axiom. I think you can, yeah. I think you don't have to think of it as some mysterious thing that's imposed on you externally, but, and maybe I can make you more comfortable about it after the class, but at this stage, sort of not to sort of get to it, but just think of it as a, you know, axiom if you want, and yeah. Yeah.
So now is that correctly, this M is the, I mean, the mass of, I mean, measured by a asymptotic observer of this level, is that correct? So is this the definition of M?
No, but you might get a better definition in the afternoon if that goes into it. But you can think of, okay, if you have a space-time like this, or a bit more general with some radial coordinate, which goes to infinity as you go towards the boundary, to get asymptotic flatness, there's a condition that the metric falls off with sufficient rate, at least like 1 over r, where r will asymptotically be measuring a sort of proper distance, you know, towards outward in the sort of radial direction. And you can think of it as sort of a conserved quantity, a charge, you know, of the space-time as you integrate, you know, think of sort of the Gauss's law as you integrate at a large sphere the fall of, the leading fall off of the metric from the flat space, you know, over a large sphere, the r's will cancel out, and the limit, it will be some constant, and it's precisely the coefficient of the leading 1 over r fall off.
And like, how is this related with the mass, like, I mean, observed by this observer?
So it is precisely, so if you calculate the mass the way that I just described, and compare with what you would get for Keplerian orbits, right, where the say the orbital frequency and so forth has a relation between the radius of the orbit and the mass of the object it's orbiting, then you would get the mass coincide with precisely this coefficient.
Yeah, like how can M ever be smaller than zero, like just based on this?
Yeah, so physically it's not. That's why I'm saying it's unphysical. You don't encounter it in nature. But as a solution, right, we wrote down some ansatz, we found some solution. We found a solution where this came in as an integration constant. I could have chosen it from just the math. I could have chosen it to be anything. If I plug this ansatz back into Einstein's equations, I would get the right-hand side of Einstein's equations being zero identically. I would have solved Einstein's equations with any parameter here, any constant. So to that extent, that it is one of the solutions, but it's unphysical. Good. Okay, so if you do this exercise, let's see, maybe I'll continue on this blackboard. So if you do this exercise and just find V effective, which I'll let you do on the homework. I think I have done too much of the homework for you. Okay. you'll find that this function, this effective potential as a function of r, is minus kappa plus e squared, it's a constant term, over 2 plus kappa over mr. Let me just get the coefficients of 2. It's kappa. All right, then there's a kappa m over r. There's an L squared over 2 R squared, and there's a minus L squared M over R cubed. right? When I've sort of expanded it in collecting powers of R. So here, this is some constant. So remember, kappa again is just 0 or plus or minus 1, depending on what type of geodesic you're considering. So if you're considering time-like geodesics, you just set kappa to be minus 1. Then to get, starting from infinity, to get an unbound motion, unbound orbit, so out here, the constant term has to have an energy greater than 1 to get something like this. So E is, for E greater than 1, you start the effective potential negative, which means that you can have, since this is negative and the whole thing is 0, R dot squared is positive, which means that the particle can get there. It has a real velocity. If the energy was smaller than 1, you would be somewhere here. If the potential was up here, then the total energy, then R dot would have to be imaginary, so the particle can't get there. So if the potential started here and was like this, it means that you could only, you would have a bound orbit which could only get up to this point and then fall back. Okay, so if we have energy greater than 1, it means that the particle is moving with something on top of its rest mass, which was just equal to 1. It's moving with some velocity. If it starts here, I would be just dropping in the particle from rest from infinity. OK, so it has some constant here. Then the first fall off is minus m over r. That's the standard Newtonian potential, okay, the Newtonian attraction. It's going to go down. The next guy, if L, the angular momentum, is non-zero, then you have a positive bit. So this is going to, this term is going to kick in and start turning the potential up. So there is a, this corresponds to the, again, standard centrifugal repulsion when you have some finite impact parameter for the particle, some finite angular momentum. The thing is not just going to fall radially, even in flat space, radially to the origin if it has angular momentum. So that's all familiar from just Newtonian physics or Keplerian orbits. The new bit in GR is this guy. This guy has a minus sign, so it's going to kick the potential to be divergent at r equal to 0 back down here. And now, from the interplay of these parameters, the mass of the black hole and the angular momentum for the geodesic, and well, the energy of the geodesic just shifts this up and down overall, you can get various, you know, these, you can shift this graph up and down and sort of change the relative size of these. But one thing you can already read of is that at least for some range of these parameters, there will be a stable circular orbit, meaning that if you shift the energy such that the zero of energy is here, V effective would be zero, and then V prime effective would be zero, meaning that R dot is zero. R doesn't move. The particle is just sitting here. But it will still be moving, you know, with some angular momentum here. Phi dot will be non-zero. It will be changing. And of course, T dot will be non-zero. So it will be orbiting, meaning on a space-time trajectory, it will be moving in time, and it will be moving in the angle. But it will have this stay put in at constant radius, so it will be just a circular orbit. Here, there's also a circular orbit. That's a new feature in GR, that it's an unstable circular orbit. If you deform it a little bit, it's going to either run away to infinity or fall into the black hole. Okay, that you don't have for, you know, Keplerian orbits. So you can already read off lots of things just from plotting the effective potential without actually doing any of the calculations. But you can do the explicit calculations. You can just integrate. You can take, you know, R dot from here, and you can find lambda of R by integrating, you know, square root of 1 over square root of 2 V effective, and take that integral, invert to get R of lambda, and then plug in here to find T of lambda and phi of lambda. Okay, so you can do it explicitly. It's just this rather messy integration. And one more comment. If you want to do something like, say, solving for precession of the perihelion of the orbits, which means that, you know, instead of going in perfect ellipses like they would in Keplerian orbit, the frequency in the orbital frequency coming from here and the radial frequency, meaning the ellipse being not the, you know, having some elongation, that thing is not perfectly matched because this is not a perfect parabola. But again, by expanding to leading order, you can figure out the deviation from the parabola and you can figure out the rate of this precession of the perihelion by a relatively simple calculation.
Well, in this picture, you have this unstable
circular orbit,
which has higher energy than the infinity.
So here I'm imagining I'm going to shift my energy so that now the potential will be like this. So E here in this case just comes additively. So I can pick my parameters. M is fixed from the spacetime, but I can pick L and R such that I can be sitting here, and then compared to what L I have, I can pick E such that the overall V effective comes zero here.
Right. But, I mean, the point is a feature of the graph. So this local maxima is higher than the R infinity maxima. Is this always the case?
No, it doesn't have to be. So if you have L zero, this thing will just keep going down, right? So if you have small L, so eventually what happens is that these zeros just, these roots just come together. You have some turning, some inflection point, but because it's just inflection, it's going to be underneath whatever this was. So if you don't hit it quite as much, there's a continuity in changing the parameters continuously. So certainly there is some point where it's underneath. Yeah.
But in case you don't, how does this change for, how does V effective change when you consider black hole in the AD space?
Ah, good. No, at the rate I'm not going to get to it, but it's a very important exercise. And in fact, you'll get to work out the V effective for just ADS, which already has interesting features. But it does change a lot. The main difference in ADS is that there's going to be a term at large R that dominates from the constant and is going to turn it up as a quadratic, as a sort of a, you know, harmonic oscillator type potential. Okay. So there won't be time-like orbits that can make it all the way out to infinity. On top of that, you still have the black hole, and you still have all these. If you have small cosmological constant, again by continuity, you can have black hole that's much smaller scale size than the scale associated with the cosmological constant, and a separation of scales. And then everything you're saying about the black hole here will pertain to the black hole in ADS as long as you're not sampling the cosmological constant scale. So if you take small black hole in ADS, local it's going to look just like it would for Schwarzschild, and eventually you'll get the ADS type behavior. If the black hole is comparable to ADS scale, so you no longer have separation of scales, you'll have richer dynamics. Then there's a more interesting interplay. But yeah, you'll get to work a bit of that in the problem sets and probably a lot more later here in the other, from the other lectures. Okay, so that's how you can find out what the time-like geodesics do, and you'll get an exercise of working out what null geodesics do. The interesting thing here is that, light also gets bent, of course, by the black hole, and in fact, it can get bent such that it also has circular orbits. And so you can shine light around a black hole, and it can come back to you, so you can see yourself, around a, by looking at a black hole. In fact, you can have infinitely many orbits before the light comes back out to you. So you can have the phenomena of so-called Einstein rings, where you see some distant star, but you see it instead of a point-like object, you see it as a full ring or arc around a black hole. This is used in sort of gravitational lensing to look at the deformation of the space-time geometry around a black hole. Acts like a lens. In fact, if you go to the LIGO website there's a couple of these movies, simulations of, you know, what it would look like if you were looking at the event that we just observed the gravitational waves from, if that system was in our galaxy and you were looking through these orbiting black holes to the distant stars, so you would see them lensed. It's a very cool movie, so I recommend that you go to the LIGO website and look at it, because it's really, you know, emphasizes how much the geometry deviates from flat space-time. You really have a lot of interesting effects. But all of it is just from solving these geodesics, well, now in a little bit more complicated geometry, because you don't have one black hole but two, but the same type of thing, this lensing would go for one as well. All right. Now let's go to the fun stuff, this causal structure. Okay, the causal structure is given by, you know, what you can causally communicate to. So for that, the null geodesics are important. I just mentioned that you can have circular photon orbits. The more important thing is what happens, you know, to the radial orbits. So consider null radial geodesics. And okay, let's see how to get through this quickly. All right. So as you can imagine, the space-time deformation, it affects the null geodesics quite a bit. And you can already read off what the radial null geodesics are going to look like in the RT plane, because by being radial, this is zero, and by being null, this is zero. And so you're just solving for this being zero. So you can see that, you know, dr, so we have 1 minus 2m over r dt squared is equal to dr squared over 1 minus 2m over r, just from the metric. And so when you put this here and you solve for dr dt, or better, dt dr, you get the 1 over 1 minus 2m over r. And so you integrate it, and you get some logarithmic type behavior. And so you'll see that something strange happens at r goes to 2m. The t goes to plus or minus infinity. Okay, there's a logarithmic divergence in t of r. And so far away, when r is very large, then you just have t going linearly with r. That's just like the flat space. But as r goes to 2m, there is something strange that's happening to these coordinates. And so in the problem sets, one of the problem sets is just to plot the or sketch the null geodesics in the TR plane. So I'm not going to do it for you. But the trick to get past that is to change coordinates from our line element such that we get rid of this pesky coordinate singularity at r equal to 2m. And the way to do it is to adapt coordinates to these, let's say, ingoing null geodesics. So let v be t plus, what I call r star, what people usually call tortoise coordinate, which is defined precisely by this sort of dt from the null geodesic. So dr star is defined as dr over 1 minus 2m over r, which I can write an explicit expression for, but it's just this linear plus log term in r. And in terms of the V coordinates, so this is something that people call ingoing Eddington coordinates. The metric, the line element, looks like minus 1 minus 2m over r dv squared. Okay, so here the coordinates I want to use is swap t to v, but use the rest of them as I have been using. So there's a dv squared. There, I have gotten rid of the dr squared term, which was the problematic one. But instead, I'll get an off-diagonal term like this, dv dr, and then the rest is the same, just a two-sphere metric. The advantage of this is that nothing goes wrong as r goes to 2m. This is perfectly regular at r equal to 2m. Even though gvv goes to 0, the metric is invertible because there isn't a... It's off-diagonal, so the inverse metric has just this factor in the G upper RR component, but there is no divergence in, nothing diverges in either the metric or the inverse metric. Okay, so that coordinate change already, the simple one, got rid of the coordinate singularity at the horizon. So that's a good thing. The bad thing is that now we have lost this manifest time flip symmetry. The original line element had a t goes to minus t symmetry. Nothing happened if you swap t to minus t. Here, something does happen if you swap. Oh, sorry, I screwed up. Something does happen if you put v to minus v, namely, the metric becomes this. Okay, and there is a typo in my original thing. Really, if you don't swap v to minus v, it's just a plus sign. Okay, so I apologize for the typo. Okay, so. With this definition, there's a plus sign. If I had a minus sign here, there would have been a minus sign. All right, so if you swap v to minus v, you swap the sign, so this metric is not invariant. But since the original thing was, we know that there is more to the spacetime to restore that symmetry. In fact, you can check explicitly that there is more to the spacetime because, okay, so let me say not time. Time reversal symmetric, and v being minus infinite is reached at finite affine parameter. So whenever you reach infinite value of some coordinate at finite affine parameter, you know that there is more to the spacetime because a physical particle can get there in some finite time, and but you know your coordinates don't tell you what happens after that. So there is more to the spacetime, so we need to do some global extension of the geometry. Okay, so the trick is to do it in two steps. One is to first restore this time flip symmetry by taking not just v, but also u defined as t minus r star, and write a metric, a line element in terms of vu r, sorry, vu theta phi. Okay, so you swap t and r for v and u, defined this way. That restores the time flip symmetry, but it still has this problem that u being plus infinite or v being minus infinite is reached in finite affine parameter. But then you can find that the line element in these coordinates is completely fine at those values. And you can actually, well, okay, so I should do it more slowly. So you can pass to new coordinates called classical coordinates where you take functions of these Eddington coordinates, v and u, such that those functions would take the infinities to a finite value. And in fact, the physically best motivated thing to do is to adapt coordinates precisely to the affine parameter along a null geodesic. Because a null geodesic went through this infinite distance in the Eddington coordinates in finite affine parameter, Well, then the simplest thing to do is just adapt new coordinates to that affine parameter and keep going. Nothing bad happened to the geodesic, so you just keep going. And this is captured by the so-called classical coordinates, where we take, I hope we can see the difference, capital V and capital U, which are defined with respect to that Eddington coordinates as E to the, let's see, let me get the signs and coefficients right here. Little v over 4m, and this was minus e to the minus little u over 4m. And in these coordinates, the line element becomes something regular, minus 32 m squared over a function of u and v, that is what happens to this r, e to the minus, again, that function of u and v over 2m. And here you just have du dv. And then you have r squared, again, viewed as a function of u and v, d omega squared. Now, this function is given from taking a product u times v. From here, you'll get that this is given by, if you, after a line of algebra, 1 minus r over 2m times e to the r over 2m. In other words, this goes to 0 at r goes to 2m, but otherwise it's, you know, it's very well behaved. And so here, when v became minus infinity, capital V went to 0, and so we can extend the original coordinate range from V being positive to V taking all the values, and similarly extend the original range of U being negative to U taking all the real values. The extension through V and U being 0 is possible because the metric is perfectly regular at these coordinates. Okay, so that's the sort of the global extension of Schwarzschild spacetime, is to use U and V as belonging to minus infinity to infinity rather than just the half line that there was originally. That increased the range of spacetime that we're considering, and now you can check that in this way of writing the metric, the boundaries of the spacetime are indeed reached only at infinite affine parameters, so you have no more extension to do. There's a bunch of questions, okay.
Which one is the affine parameter again? I just lost track.
Well, I didn't write it down. It's the lambda that would have come into this everywhere I'm writing this dot. It's this lambda that ticking off, it parameterizes the geodesic in such a way that as you parallel transform the tangent vector to the geodesic, it happens to be the, it falls on itself. It falls on the tangent vector to the geodesic at the later affine parameter. Like here, if this parallel transported along here to something much longer, then the parameterization would not have been affine if you transported to this, but instead the affine parameter ensures that the length stays the same. In the case of null geodesic, the length is zero, but you still have the same notion of ticking of sort of equal increments along the geodesic. Yeah.
Not geodesics, this is not an invariant quantity.
It is. So it's you still have this being constant. It's invariant under changing, but you still have a notion of affineness. In other words, rescaling the parameter would give you some non-affine thing. It's just it's not a length or a time because that would be zero. Yeah.
So this global extension, the space that you get that way, is it bigger than the space that you started with?
Yes,
in
good.
R
so
and
let's
t
see.
Coordinates?
Good. So let's see what you get. So let's plot u and v are both null because there is no du squared or dv squared term in the metric. Okay, so the norm of ddu and ddv are null. So let me draw u and v as diagonal axes like this. So this is v and this is u. And that corresponds to r equal to 2m on both of these. as r goes to infinity, here uv goes to infinity. Sorry, uv goes to minus infinity. So the boundary here is infinite distance in these directions. As r goes to 0, uv goes to 1. And in fact, so let me draw the singularity by a wiggly line. So there will be some hyperbola, which has two branches, of r being 0. So this is r is 0 here and r is 0 here. And there is no space-time for negative r, so space-time just ends here. And what we started out with, the original RT coordinate system, is valid everywhere that there is not a coordinate singularity. The coordinate singularity was at r equal to 2m. So the RT patch is valid either here, or in just this, or in just this, or in just this one. You can use it in any of the four patches, but you cannot go across because there is a coordinate singularity in the original coordinates. Okay, so mostly people think of the RT system as valid here, but you can use it here, but it's just you have to be careful about, you know, not getting entangled in the coordinate singularity when you're crossing this horizon. The most important thing about this set of coordinates, apart from it containing the entire space-time, is that because constants of u and v correspond to radial null geodesics, and well, each point here corresponds to a two-sphere, the light cones in the space-time on this UV plane always go at 45-degree angle, no matter, you know, where you draw them. Okay, that's the nicest feature about this Kresko diagram. And so it immediately tells you that if you're, so you always remember have to move along a trajectory within the local light cone. So you can have a physical observer coming like this, but you cannot have an observer doing this. That would be going in a space-like direction, and that's disallowed. And so if you stick to within 45 degrees, you see that once you get inside this region, you can never make it back out. You're always confined to be within this region, and in fact, you're always confined to end at this singularity. Okay, and so that's why this region is called a black hole. Once you're inside it, you cannot get outside, and in fact, that means that, you know, there is no photons that could go from here to here, and therefore you cannot see what's inside, and that's why it's called black. Okay. Now, there's a better way to draw this diagram, so I'll postpone explaining more of the physics till I draw the better diagram. The better diagram is the so-called Pedagos diagram, and you'll be seeing lots of these in the later lectures. So the Penrose diagram is essentially, well, keeps the good thing about light rays being at 45 degrees, but in addition, it also brings infinity, you know, to be drawn at a finite distance so that we can see the entire space. Actually, it does a little bit more than that. It adds the boundary of the space-time to be a place where you can still, you know, talk about how various objects have fall off and so forth. But at a, you know, naive level, you can just think of it as transforming the coordinates. You compactify the space-time, keeping light rays at 45 degrees everywhere, but bringing the boundary infinity to finite distance in that diagram. Okay, and what happens to this? So there's an easy thing to do of writing new coordinates where the extent of this is like, say, 10 of some other coordinate, let's say u tilde, and v is 10 of, let's say, v tilde. So in the new u tilde, v tilde coordinates, these never range more than, well, u and v take infinite value when this is pi half. So the spacetime would be capped off like this. But moreover, uv equal to this product equal to 1 is actually drawn as a straight line like this. So you also don't have this bit of the diagram. Okay, and uv being 0 corresponds to this. And so let me redraw it without the axes and redraw it with a squiggly line for the singularity. So you have a straight line, well, wiggly line that's sort of going straight for the singularity. You have the horizons, and you have now the asymptotic regions at r equal to infinity look like this. Okay, so if I draw constant r surfaces, I have, so this is r equal to 2m, this is r equal to 0. Between here, constant r surfaces, which are orbits of the original time translation d by dt, are space-like here. Outside the horizon, the orbits of d by dt, which are constant r surfaces, are time-like. Okay, that's the sort of standard familiar region. Here, r goes to infinity. And this is the same thing, r equals to 2m, r equals to 0. And r here gets large again. Okay, this is the original diagram that I had written with this that got erased, where there was a plane that went through a neck and then got large again. R goes to infinity out here as well. And so the diagram that I was drawing initially, that somebody was asking me about, was just a spatial geometry through a slice like this. So if you take a spatial geometry through here, it's sort of, now, if I keep the vertical thing, it would come in here. It would come to a smallest distance, which is perimeter 2m, and it would get large again, like this. And as you take this slice, at a later and later time, if you took it, say, here, this thing would have pinched off, would have gotten narrow because it reached smaller r value. That means the size of the two sphere that's at any given point is smaller. Up till you take it up, this slice would have gone like this, and the spatial geometry would really have pinched off completely. If you take a surface that hits the singularity, you would have two disconnected bits to the space-time, to the spatial geometry. So these are the so-called embedding diagrams that sort of show you what spatial geometry looks like. So the,
what's the physical meaning of the singularity at the bottom?
Good. So this is the so-called past curvature singularity.
Okay.
And this is the future singularity. If you have a physical star collapse, let's say, in nature, stress tensor is not zero inside the star, so the solution is valid only outside the star. And what happens is that the star starts from some regular initial condition and collapses, so the metric is only valid out here. You don't get the other asymptotic region, and you don't get the past singularity. So just to give these things names, Of course, the thing that's inside the top wedge is called a black hole. It's everything that's not visible from this region. So this is the black hole region. The time reverse of the black hole is the so-called white hole. Okay, and it's just literally the time reverse. Everything must come, escape out of it, and nothing can fall in. Whereas for black holes, nothing can get out, and things can fall in. There's two asymptotic regions. There's this one and this one, but they can't communicate with each other because they're, again, that would require some space-like motion somewhere. Okay, so there are these four separate regions. These infinities have a name which you might encounter later, so let me just say the name on here. The null infinity, the so-called future null infinity, is labeled, is denoted scry plus for future. The scry is from script I. So this is supposed to be a script I. This is the sort of endpoint. This is this whole segment, and it's the endpoint set of endpoints of null geodesics. And it's the future future null infinity. There's a past null infinity, which is labeled as scry minus, and there's another set of these scry plus and scry minus here. There's a future time-like singularity, which is labeled as I plus, and past time-like singularity that's labeled I minus. That's the endpoint of all time-like geodesics that can reach infinite affine parameter. Of course, there's some that fall into the black hole and crash into the singularity at finite affine parameter, so they don't count as part of this. This one is only when the time-like geodesics that get there at infinite affine parameter. And there's a spatial infinity that's labeled I naught. Again, there's two sets of these. That's the endpoint of all space-like geodesics. Okay, but this guy is the most important guy because, okay, so I'm rushing because I have just a few minutes and I didn't get to the ADS part. I apologize. So the generic black hole, which is not necessarily a closed form solution that you can just write down, a black hole that maybe has been sitting out there in the universe but has all sorts of junk falling into it, so the horizon can be wobbling around, it's growing, it's time dependent, we don't have a closed form solution, but we can define precisely what we mean by the black hole mathematically. And the black hole in general is defined as, let me write it here, as everything, well, as the region that you cannot see. Where you cannot see, meaning you can't, from which there is no signal that reaches infinity, meaning the scry plus. And so you can write black hole as the space-time region which is not in the past, in the causal past of scry plus. Okay, so here this is a bit of a notational jargon that you'll see in later lectures, probably. So black hole is everything that's not, so this is the manifold minus the thing that's in the past of future null infinity. So this is the full space-time. This is the causal past of future null infinity. And the event horizon is the boundary of the black hole. Okay, which is defined as the boundary of the past of the future null infinity. Okay, so this is boundary of the past of future null infinity. Okay, so you can have, and so the formal definition of a black hole, which is this, that nothing can ever escape from it, is teleological in the sense that by saying ever, you need to specify what the space-time is doing for all time, because before you can figure out, you know, what can and what cannot escape out to infinity. For example, you can collapse a black hole, and it's sitting there, and you see it in nature, and you think, okay, you know where the horizon is. But there could be, say, a shell, maybe a null spherical shell that you have no way of feeling right now, that will collapse onto it later. And the light signals that we're sending out right now, which look like they're merrily escaping out to infinity, will get gravitationally pulled back by the shell when it finally arrives. And those signals are never going to make it out here. And in fact, we have been talking about some region here that looked like it's asymptotically, you know, it's already things are escaping, but they're going to be pulled back by some shell and never escape, you know, never escape from the black hole. So in principle, we could be inside a black hole right now, according to this definition, because it could be eons from now that we discover that, you know, the light that we're, our flashlight shining out into the universe is never going to actually reach infinity. Not likely, but that's a definition, that's a formal definition of a black hole. There's a more local set of definitions, which just people, you might have heard the term apparent horizon, which captures the notion that locally gravity is strong enough that light is locally not allowed to be getting out any further. But it's that's a sort of quasi-local notion of a black hole. Okay, let me, 1 minute, tell you about ADS, because I was sort of committed. Well, there's a break now. So, how about this? Those of you who want to learn about ADS, you can stay for another few minutes. And those of you who want to have a coffee and never want to hear about ADS again, then feel free to leave. Okay, so I'll try to be fast. So ADS is a maximally symmetric solution to Einstein's equations with no matter, okay, so vacuum solution, but a cosmological constant. In fact, a negative cosmological constant. So it's a negatively curved spacetime. It has a constant negative curvature. And it's a sort of Lorentzian analog of a hyperboloid. So it's like a Lorentzian, meaning it has one time direction, so Lorentzian hyperboloid. But otherwise, it has the structure of a hyperboloid in the sense that as you go, you know, outward, the distance is the perimeter gets much larger, you know, than the proper distance. For a sphere, for positive curvature, it would have gone the other way. You know, we can think of, you know, one of these lettuce leaves or something like that. And you can think of it, this maximal symmetry, you can think of just like embedding a two-sphere into an R3. You can embed a surface minus, let's say, x minus 1 squared minus x naught squared plus x1 squared plus, let's say, xd squared equals minus some length scale, embedded into a flat space-time of minus 2 comma d signature, so minus dx minus 1 squared minus dx not squared plus dx 1 squared plus up to dx d squared. Okay, so this is a flat space. Okay, and what you find is that, well, if you plot the time directions like this, x naught, x minus 1, and these are the spatial directions, you have a hyperboloid that looks like this. And this will correspond to a time. You can sort of cut this up and decompactify it so that you don't have any closed time-like curves. And you can do so for your exercise. I made you do one very nice way of sort of combining these to do an embedding that gives, writes ADS in so-called global coordinates, which manifest a static, which is static and spherically symmetric. So you combine the spatial things into a sphere and combine the time directions into a time. And the line element that you get from that is minus r squared plus 1 dt squared plus dr squared over r squared plus 1 plus r squared d omega squared. Let's say the sphere was d minus 1 dimensional. This gives you an ADS d plus 1 in d spatial and one time dimension. Okay? So this is very similar to the metric, the line element we got for Schwarzschild, except that here you have, this is not asymptotically flat. At large r, it's the r squared that dominates, not the 1. But for small r, you know, at the near the origin, r equal to 0, it looks just like flat space. Okay. So that's ADS, and it has not this asymptotically flat structure, but rather the boundary. So if you go to the boundary, suppose you're at constant r surface. At constant r surface, you forget about this, and then as you take the limit to large r, the t and the sphere directions grow the same way. So you can shrink all the distances back by dividing by R squared, and you find the metric being what's called the Einstein static universe, just minus dt squared plus d omega squared. And you find that the boundary then is a time-like surface. And so the Penrose diagram, you can think of the ADS as the interior of a cylinder. Okay, cylinder looking like this, which now sort of keeps going. This is the r direction that goes to infinity somewhere. I have just compactified that. There's an angular direction, which is the phi, well, which is one of the spherical directions. And there's the time direction, t, that just runs up everywhere like that. All right. So that's one representation of ADS, the so-called global ADS, that manifests the sort of static, the time translation symmetry in the global ADS and spherical symmetry. There's many other representations, because this is just keeping, you know, SOD times time translation out of that one was full SO2, D minus 1, or D minus 1, 2, depending on your convention. Here is just some small subset of that. You can have another subset that manifests a spatially translational symmetry. There is no real origin to the ADS spacetime. So that's in something called Poincaré ADS, which is sort of translationally symmetric. So that's a different type of embedding from these embedding coordinates. That has a metric that looks sort of simpler. Oh, and by the way, I have suppressed the length scale. I have set this curly L to 1 in this line element. But if I reinstated it, it would be R over L instead of R up in the GTD and GRR. But suppressing it still, I get a 1 over z squared plus, okay, here you have a standard Minkowski type metric that manifests this translational invariance. Let me just say dxi, dxi. And then you have a plus dz squared. So z is now a, so these are called the boundary coordinates, and this is an extra radial coordinate. That's another representation. And for many people who sort of approached ADS-CFT from condensed matter, this is the metric that they have seen. But that only describes a part of the spacetime. It describes the so-called Poincaré patch of global ADS, which is, let's see, what's my color choice? Well, never mind. Which is a wedge that looks like this. Okay, where this would be the surface z equal to infinity. This would be z equal to 0. And constant x surfaces would be sort of looking like this. Constant z surfaces would be looking like this. And time translation, well, sorry, this t is distinct from that t. Should maybe call it something else, t bar. This is d d t bar, whereas this is dt. So I have put, I'll put notes on the online, and I'll put an actual plot of this so that you can see it a bit more clearly.
Are the two dxi's the same in your formula? The index xi, dxi.
This is supposed to be a little x, distinct from those big x's, but these two x's are the same.
Oh, but two,
and the i's are just, it's just saying like d little x, 1 squared d little x, 2 squared, so forth. This is just the summation over I.
But your I appears at the lower index.
That's just to denote the summation of
it.
Okay, if that's not comfortable, just do it this way. Okay, and then there's a d in d plus one dimensions, there's a d minus one of these guys. Okay, so that's the Poincaré ADS. And the nifty thing about the black hole in ADS is if you go to this global ADS picture, you can sort of combine the line elements of Schwarzschild and the line element of ADS and do something really cheesy. You can do, you can add here a minus, you know, say 2m over r, and here minus 2m over r, and you get a Schwarzschild ADS. Okay, you can't do this in general, but it actually works in this coordinate system. And so this metric is metric of a black hole in ADS, and the Penrose diagram for a black hole in ADS, for small r, you can ignore the r squared, so there will be something that looks like the Schwarzschild black hole, but as you go to large radius, you don't get this asymptotically flat thing, but you get a sort of asymptotically time-like boundary. In fact, it's not quite like this because you can't, in higher dimensions, you can't keep both the singularity and the boundary straight. So really, you have to sort of deform one or the other. So strictly speaking, the Penrose diagram for Schwarzschild ADS sort of looks like this, with the singularity sort of bent in. If you're in three dimensions, it really does look like what I had drawn a moment ago with straight singularities and boundaries. But you can sort of eyeball it, you can figure out what the Penrose diagram should look like by sort of composing, you know, what it should look like near the singularity, what it should like near infinity, and sort of putting them together like this. Okay, but you can actually plot the Penrose diagram from doing this sort of exercise and the global extension and compactifying the Kruskal diagram and get an explicit plot. So again, if any of you are interested, I can explain that more in detail. Okay, so let me end here, and I'll just stay here to break.